Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Well, happy Tuesday and welcome to episode 39 of Global Leader Radio. And the purpose of our show is to educate our learning community, add value to all those who seek to optimize their leadership acumen, and of course, engage in conversations that highlight the same. So we achieve this purpose by providing our learning community with key takeaways, including resources and valuable tips and advice that have led to the personal and professional success of our guests. And we've got two great ones today. So today's discussion is centered on applying leadership in the corporate, entrepreneurial, and not-for-profit applications and sectors. So with that overview, we welcome our guests today, Sharon Simpson Joseph and Pat Pittard. So Sharon is the executive director of Youth Spark Incorporated, a nonprofit organization dedicated to juvenile justice and social service reform. In this role, Sharon serves as the chief visionary responsible for leading a cadre of collaborators committed to growing this movement. You like those C's all together in there, right? Sharon is a member of the California State Bar, and she has served as legal counsel to the legendary Mayor Tom Bradley of Los Angeles, and she has practiced corporate law and municipal finance, as well as constitutional law and marketing for nonprofits. A member of the California State Bar, as I said before, and she served as associate editor of the Stanford Law Review. She received a Bachelor of Science in Broadcast Journalism at Boston University, and she's a graduate of Stanford's Law School. And in addition to her professional pursuits, Sharon is a former marathoner, a writer, and a poet. And she has a book to her credit as well. And she lives in Atlanta, Georgia, with her husband, Dr. Robert Joseph, sons Robert Luke and Joshua, and a Cocker Spaniel named Henry, the county I actually live in. So Patrick S. Pat Pittard is founder and chairman of Patrick Pittard Advisors, a human capital advisory firm focusing on C-level leadership services, including executive search, talent assessment, talent audits, and human capital consulting. Pat is a retired CEO and chairman of Hedrick and Struggles International Incorporated and the former founder, chairman, and CEO of Act Bridges Incorporated. So Pat has appeared on multiple business broadcast media such as CNN, MSNBC, and Power Lunch, and he is often quoted in the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, and Business Week, as well as many international publications. So Pat is a distinguished executive in residence at the University of Georgia's Terry College of Business. So this is a faculty position, and each fall he teaches lessons in leadership. Students are candidates for either the MBA, law, and BBA degrees. And so over 50 different CEOs have served as guest lecturers with Pat. Pat received his Bachelor's of Business Administration degree in management from the Terry College of Business at the University of Georgia. So given that overview, we welcome both Sharon and Pat to today's edition of Global Leader Radio. So how are both of you?
Good, good.
Doing great. It's good to be here.
Well, fantastic. So Sharon, if you don't mind, we'll begin with you. So please tell us a little bit about your background, starting with your original birthplace, home, and a bit about your work experience, and then take us up to the present.
Okay. I'll probably need you to pace me on that.
So. There you go.
Okay. So it's great to be here. I actually call myself a New York Californian who now makes her home in Atlanta. That's a good way to describe me. So if I start at the beginning then, I was born in New York, grew up there, and I guess I've always, you know, well, you talked about me being a writer and a poet. I think that I've always had this heart or spirit for justice and for change, even when I was a little kid. Hmm. And I think sometimes that when you have a heart for that, so, you know, for wanting to see things, just wanting to see things fair, like if there's a kid in the class that's being picked on, I'm the kid that's saying, you know, that's not okay. What can we do about that? I think sometimes it makes you popular and sometimes it makes you unpopular. And I believe that's kind of like the early seeds of how you become a leader then, because if you believe in something, you kind of have to go for it, however that challenge, whatever that challenge looks like.
Hmm.
So,
Great point. So tell us a little bit about what happened on the West Coast now, because you covered the East Coast.
Okay, so I went to the West Coast to go to Stanford for law school. Figured if I loved California, I'd stay. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I did love it. I went to law school really because I wanted to understand significantly more about what makes this country tick. In essence, I wanted to understand, well, what is it that I can do to help make change in our nation and to make a difference for those who are disenfranchised, which sadly oftentimes is, you know, are many people, but certainly women and children. And so that's been a theme throughout my life, is working working on behalf of children and working on behalf of women's issues as well. And I studied those areas at Stanford. I did a lot of nonprofit work over the summers. I also worked in the corporate environments in law firms as well. When I graduated from law school, I did my Stanford Law Review note on the struggle of incarcerated mothers.
Wow.
So that's the type of work I'm passionate about.
Yeah, and we love passion on Global Leader Radio.
That's good.
So
so
where'd you meet your husband? Did y'all get together on the East Coast or the West Coast?
Actually, I met my husband as I was moving to the East Coast. So I've been in California for many years, and you talked about some of my work journey, but I decided that I wanted to move it to Atlanta and just really see how I could make a difference and make change here. And my mom had relocated here. I thought, okay, I'm going to go ahead and try something different. And as I was moving here, I met him.
Well, and we are infinitely better for it. Yeah. We don't need you on either one of those other two coasts,
well,
right, Kevin?
You.
Definitely.
I like to think I can be all places, you know?
Ubiquitous.
Yeah,
I love it.
You know, just keep it moving. I mean, that's what we have to do in managing a nonprofit. And with the type of work that I do, it really, you know, I know we're going to get into that some more, but it's, you know, around fighting child sex trafficking. It's a global and certainly national issue.
Hence. Well, we're actually going there now. So give us a little background information on Youth Spark and how you work to impact the lives of others through this extraordinary effort.
Okay. So with Youth Spark, where we work to ignite justice and inspire change, that's our mission. We actually are pioneers in the movement to end child sex trafficking. And I guess I want to spend just a moment talking about that, because I know some of your listeners will be saying, child sex trafficking, okay, you know, I know she's based in Georgia, but she must then really have a job that takes her out of the country a lot, because they're thinking that type of thing doesn't go on here in the U.S.
Right.
And that is not the case at all. Unfortunately, it's very prominent here in the United States and, in fact, in Georgia. Atlanta, sadly, is one of the top cities where we have to work to fight
wow.
child sex trafficking, because it is one of the top cities for that particular heinous form of child abuse. So with Youth Spark, and actually our former name is the Juvenile Justice Fund, we've been doing this work for over a decade, which really makes us one of the pioneers in this movement in this nation. We were doing this work when everybody would have looked at me and said, are you crazy to even be talking about this? Now more and more people are understanding that this challenge is out there and therefore joining the movement to end and prevent child sex trafficking. But it's been a very long journey that we've traveled to get to the point where I'm able to sit here and talk about it and know that many of your listeners will know exactly what I'm talking about. And lastly, I guess I want to say in that regard that President Obama this past fall issued an executive order declaring that the United States will not tolerate human trafficking either abroad or here domestically. And that's begun to also really transform the entire movement in this arena, because more and more strategically the federal government is also becoming a partner in ending and eradicating child sex trafficking.
Interesting. So when you say child sex trafficking, I guess there are two ends to that spectrum, right? There's the supply, and then there's also the demand. So what makes Atlanta such a rich place? Is it one or the other, or how does that work?
Yeah, I really appreciate you asking the question about supply and demand, because, again, there are probably some listeners saying, wow, okay, that's an interesting way to define this problem. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that, unfortunately, you have to understand that sex trafficking is just it's a business, a heinous business, but a business nonetheless. Mm-hmm. In fact, second only basically to guns and drugs worldwide.
Wow.
Human trafficking, that is. So from a supply and demand side, just to clarify, that means that the supply, unfortunately, are our children.
Mm-hmm.
And then the demand are those who would seek to buy sex from our children, those who would seek to prostitute them. Those are purchasers, if you will, or the more common vernacular for that are johns. And then also those who would pimp them. And unfortunately, that's a huge population right there.
Where are these kids coming from?
Sure. I think there's a misunderstanding sometimes in the thought that perhaps all the children are coming from other countries being brought here and then prostituted. Certainly that is the case at times, but we're also talking about children who've grown up right here in Georgia and the surrounding states who are being prostituted. Hmm. One important statistic, there are, let's say, for every three teens that run away from home, one out of three of those teens will be prostituted in the first 48 hours after they've left home. Yeah.
Keep an eye on your kids.
Absolutely. Yes. That's exactly right. And the thing is that you said that so well, because the problem is that when you say keep an eye on your kids, and unfortunately for many kids, there's no one keeping an eye on them. You know, and that is the sad and devastating truth. I think for me personally, in terms of why do I do this work, because I believe in all of us being able to support and help children. So like part of my mission then is if there's no one else that's able to keep an eye on them, that's what we're committed to. So at YouthSpark, we are a growing movement actually of pioneers who are working to end child sex trafficking through prevention. And that is youth and adults alike. Our movement actually combines young people also who are lifting their voice and saying, this is unacceptable. And this includes both children who have not been prostituted, who are saying, wait a second, my contemporaries, this is happening to them, my peers, I've got to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And it also includes survivors and young people who have lived to tell about it, and I might add that not all do, who are also saying, you know what, this may have happened to me, but I'm not going to let this happen to another child. So for us at YouthSpark, our commitment is to hope and compassion, excellence, responsibility in being able to make change in this. And I emphasize that because oftentimes when people hear about this issue, you know, it's devastating it's shocking and devastating. So the temptation is to pull back versus to move forward into the movement. And so for us, we're saying, you know what? Yes, this is devastating, but we have hope that we can make change. We're providing a positive shift in how we drive this movement forward, and we're inviting everyone to come in and to be a part of making a difference in ending child sex trafficking, which ultimately then transforms the lives of children who have been exploited or abused and neglected, and replaces that devastating hole with health and well-being, and then being able to go forward positively and powerfully.
Very well put. So now, are the volunteers that work, I'm assuming there's a cadre of volunteers as well as those who are on staff. Can you explain a little bit about the organizational side of YouthSpark?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll also talk some about the leadership role that's involved for me as the executive director in that process, because part of it is, I mean, what I've just described in terms of talking about child sex trafficking, obviously it's a huge problem, a huge challenge. And, you know, we're a small to medium-sized organization that have a big vision and a big mission, and we believe the faith and the expertise to know that we actually can make change in this arena and that we already have. What that means, though, on a day-to-day basis for me as the executive director then is, well, then how does that translate into an infrastructure that's going to support the level of work that we seek to accomplish?
Mm-hmm. The total effort.
Absolutely, absolutely, and also kind of the, you know, day-to-day effort as well as the vision and mission that we put forth locally and nationally as thought leaders in this arena. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've grown stronger and stronger over the past years in being able to create a space for others to work to do this job as well, you know, to make change. So I guess I'll give two concrete examples.
Okay.
So one of them is we have the most incredible staff on the planet, so that's my shout out to the YouthSpark team. But what that means is having people who are absolutely passionate, committed, and excellent and compassionate, because we have to design a model where each individual works. We do a combination of direct service programs and advocacy and training and research and so on. So what that means is you have to be multifaceted in your skill set and in your abilities to do those things. And then so what we do then is we bring in volunteers, and that may be, you know, like when I say volunteers, I want to recognize that that means whether it's a board of director member who serves in a high-level capacity as a volunteer as well, or whether it means that it's someone who's coming in to talk to volunteering, to come to talk to our girls. We have a program called Youth Spark Voices, okay. And that program is to reach girls who are highly in danger of being sexually trafficked. Many of them have already been through the grooming process, and we're catching it in time and saying, wait, there's another road that you can travel. And so we have volunteers, whether it's a volunteer who's a survivor themselves of child sex trafficking, who can come in and talk to the girls and give them the real deal on what they need to hear, or whether it's somebody who's, you know, who's a doctor or a psychologist who's coming in and sharing, well, hey, this is the type of career that you have an opportunity to go into. Hang in there, because there's a future that's, you know, beckoning to you beyond where you're at right now. So that's kind of an example of the type of volunteers that we have.
Well, very interesting. I understand that Youth Spark began as the Juvenile Justice Fund. I remember you talking a little bit about that. So was there a strategic reason for the name change, and does that new name better convey what your organization is seeking to do?
Yeah, I love that question. well, I'll say two things about it. So we're actually based at Fulton County Juvenile Court. That's the largest juvenile court in the Southeast. So over 12,000 cases come through the court annually in the either deprivation or delinquency side. In other words, again, for children who have been abused or neglected or who are coming through the system on probation. But as you can imagine, there are a host of events and experiences that have gone in their lives to bring them to that moment.
Got it.
Because of that, we were originally called the Fulton County Juvenile Justice Fund when we first started. And then, or even in the 2 years ensuing, we realized that we were already expanding beyond the borders of solely serving the court and serving the children who were coming into the court, many of whom had been sexually exploited, and that's why we started doing this work, too.
Okay.
Over the past several years, though, as the movement has become more and more powerful in terms of people beyond our borders, and when I say our borders, I mean, for example, just even Atlanta, understanding, oh, my God, what's going on here in terms of our kids being exploited in this fashion, we realized that we needed also to be able to evolve our name and mission with how far we'd grown. So we absolutely still, you know, very much partner with the juvenile court and serve the court directly. But, you know, the term juvenile is actually kind of 20th century, really, in a lot of ways, whereas Youth Spark is truly about that, again, that sense of compassion and hope of youth leadership and of recognition that, you know, there's a spark that lives within each of us and certainly within each youth. Whether it has the opportunity to shine forth or not, you know, that's the opportunity there to be able to help make change. And so for us, Youth Spark, when I say that word, I feel something in my spirit, in my gut, in my core. I hope that you all do too. That's why we changed the name, to be able to in a stronger fashion, represent what the difference is that we're making in the world and what the stand is that we're taking to allow everybody's spark to shine.
I love that right there.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. So we'll hit the pause button just ever so slightly, Sharon, and we're going to pivot over to Patrick, or Pat Pittard. He's the founder and chairman of Patrick Pittard Advisors, a human capital advisory firm focusing on C-level leadership services, including executive search, talent assessment, talent audits, and human capital consulting. So how are you again, sir?
Good.
Doing good. So good. Glad to have you here too. So tell us a little bit about your background. Tell us a little bit about the man behind the leader.
Well, I'm one of the five people you'll meet that was born in Atlanta that still lives here.
Only five.
And so look around at all your friends and ask how many of them were born in Atlanta. So, and I'm as local as they get. I went to public schools. I went to public college at the University of Georgia. I did my unfinished graduate work at Georgia State. So I'm as local as they come. I have lived my professional life all in leadership in some form or fashion. I either was in leadership roles and different organizations, including being a chief executive officer of a public company, as well as being a founder of a startup company. And someday at another time, we can talk about the differences in the skill levels that are needed for that. And I've been involved in leadership either by being one, by recruiting leaders, because Heidrick & Struggles, when I was there, was the largest executive search firm in the world.
Wow.
It had dozens of offices in the United States, Europe, and Asia. And the thing that we were known most for is doing chief executive officer searches.
Okay. For any one industry, or was it across the board?
Well, we had industry specialists that reported to me that were in charge of certain industries.
Okay.
But we were a generalist firm. We did it all. It's like being, you know, Mayo Clinic. You do it all, but you do have specialties within it.
Exactly.
And so, and then I was involved in taking that company public. And I saw in the paper this morning that now they're thinking about taking themselves private.
Full circle.
So different things happen at different times. I had started my career as a teacher, and I have gone full circle now, where I'm doing that again. I took a pause to be a leader, and now I teach about leadership. And the way that I teach about leadership is I bring leaders to class, sit him or her on the bar stool in front of 88 students and say, talk about leadership.
Okay.
And we don't want to hear your corporate story. We don't want to hear, you know, what you say to your shareholders at the shareholders meeting. We want to know your biggest mess up.
Yeah.
And how did you get yourself out of that, and how did you get yourself in that to begin with? And it becomes a very real conversation back with this chief executive officer. Very often, a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, or often running a not-for-profit that has 50,000 employees and employees and volunteers and impacts millions of people.
Right.
And so, and then also we like to have an entrepreneur speak, and we had a lady that started a dating service, and so we had her come and talk about it. By the way, it's been quite successful.
Was it an online dating service, or?
It is both.
It
is the advisor kind of model, and then there's an online model.
Okay.
But anyway, we have had a number of different types of leaders there, but you have to be the ultimate authority in whatever organization it is to speak. And so I don't bring in the CFOs and the second level. We want the person that where the buck stops.
Gotcha.
And so and then teaching future leaders is what I'm doing now.
Okay.
Mostly, and I'm helping people mold their toolbox to the things that they need in order to lead and lead well, because leadership is clearly a taught and learned talent. It is, you're not born with it.
Right.
And so you can think you're born with it, but you better learn something quick.
But it has to be developed, no doubt about
Absolutely.
It. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's not just a trait. That trait theory is something that was came up.
Some people with, you know, charisma and confidence will pick it up faster, maybe, but they're not going to be a leader just because they've got charisma.
Gotcha.
So that's what I've done. It's not as far away a subject to – is it Sharon? Is that the right – it's not as far away from a subject of what Sharon does as you would think, because I've done a number of leadership engagements myself for not-for-profits. And I have found that the ability for somebody to run a extraordinary organization has to have two really important things, passion and humility. And if you've got those two things, you can lead. Now, there are people that have humility that have enormous egos. It doesn't mean that they don't care about humans and that they don't care about doing what's right for human, but they have enormous egos. You know, Bill Gates, I think, gave away $60 billion to start the Gates Foundation.
Right.
And so there's an ego for you. And we did a lot of search work for Bill Gates. And so
so you know him well, huh?
Well, I know him. I don't know anybody knows him well. And we did the search, for example, for the CEO of Apple and CEO of all the big companies, Home Depot, and I can keep going on.
Well, so, I want to talk a little bit more about that. I want you to tell us a little bit about your firm and some of the great work you're doing there.
Because
it sounds like you talked a little bit about your faculty work, and that's a little different than your advisory work.
And that's where I am now. I'm mostly in the training of future leaders. But anyway, the firm was founded 60 years ago It was founded by two German immigrants, Heydrich and Struggles, and they both ended up in Chicago in human resource roles. And they kept thinking that the level of recruitment that was being done at the highest level was not professional enough. Mm-hmm. And so they started a company, the two of them, that later became the largest firm in the industry.
Wow.
And probably over the years, one of the most respected, if not the most respected firm in the business. And so I came into it in Atlanta as a recruiter.
Okay.
And then I ran Atlanta, then I ran bigger parts of the company until ultimately I became chief executive officer. For financial reasons, I talked my partners into taking it public. We merged with our European colleagues, which we had been separated from for 20 years. And we merged with them and became a global company. And then I left and walked the Appalachian Trail.
Like
I really was on the Appalachian Trail.
You actually did walk that trail, right? Now, how long a walk is that, by the way?
It's 2,200 miles.
Wow.
You go through 14 states. Some Georgia Tech engineer decided it was 5 million steps.
Wow.
It takes 6 months, about 6.5 months to do. If you do it without a break, it takes six and a half months to do.
You mean without a day off?
No, you have to take a day off. Your body will collapse on
you. I'm wondering. Okay, thank you.
But a lot of people hike the Appalachian Trail in pieces over a period of 20 years.
Gotcha. Okay.
And they're called section hikers. And then there's another kind where a person puts aside 7 months of their life and just does it all in one continuous hike, and they're called through hikers. And there's maybe 100 of those a year, and I'll probably 5,000 or 6,000 try. And 100 or 200 make it every year as a through hike.
And you were one of those?
Awesome. I'm one of those. It's you leave from Georgia to Maine, or you leave in Maine and end in Georgia, one of the two. So anyway, when that was over, I didn't know what I was going to do. And that's when George Benson, who was the dean of the business school at that time at the University of Georgia, said, come to the university and teach. And so that's how I got into that business.
Okay.
So, but I took a three-year break recently to start a startup company that would put science into the selection process.
Okay.
The selection process is these series of interviews that some companies are very good at, other companies are very bad at, but there is a scientific way that would help everybody, whether you're good or bad at it. And so that company is still going fine. I left it a month or so ago. I'm good at fixing things and starting things, but once it's running well, get rid of me. You know,
you don't want to be in the maintenance business, right?
So I've lived in that world of leadership, and we made sure in our firm that all of our partners, and we had over 400 partners at one time, did some amount of their work pro bono.
Okay.
That they did some amount of their work for their local communities and the local community organizations and national communities, and that we not only allowed it, we thought it was a part of being a corporate citizen. So, I mean, whether you're working with a small boutique not-for-profit that's trying to take care of battered women, or whether it's a big, humongous problem like all the cancers there are in the world. So we would take on those. So we've touched leadership in all kinds of different ways.
So today, are you doing human capital and talent management in addition to your faculty work?
Yeah, in my experience, of course, I develop like a barnacle relationships with different corporations and individuals, and they'll call on me from time to time when they need to do a search or they need to. I'll often get called by colleagues that will say, "Listen, I'm about to bring this person into my organization. Would you please meet with them and spend a day with them and come back with your assessment and that sort of thing?" So, I'll sell that service, or I'll sell a search. Or if there is an organization that's having difficulties in making their revenues and compensation balance right, you know, I'll help with that. Often, the biggest value I can bring is I can say, I don't know enough about this problem to solve it, but I know who does.
Okay.
And so I'll get that person to get in touch with you. And if they can't, if they don't have the time or they can't solve the problem, come back to me and I'll
find somebody else.
But because human capital now is where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can't make it work through your people, then you're not going to make it work.
Right,
and so
right.
Everything in today's world is too complex for one person to run it.
Mm.
So you've got to have ability to lead leaders. And so so that's what I talk about in my class and a number of different things, and that's what I do in terms of my own consulting experience.
Okay. So now are the bulk of your clients located locally, those that come to you?
All over the world.
All over the world.
Yeah.
Okay. And so can you talk about perhaps the trends you're noticing in the human capital talent management arena? Are you getting certain types of calls, or does
matter? There's things we don't like to see, but they're the reality of business today. And that is that there was a time, and one even 2 decades ago, that the United States was so far behind in productivity and service from Japan or Korea or China or now Vietnam. These are incredibly productive people, and they get tons done per dollar.
Mm.
And so the United States was falling behind in manufacturing. That has changed. In the last 4 or 5 years, all of these corporations that were shipping their jobs offshore are coming back into the United States today, and foreign countries are coming to our country to do their manufacturing because there have been enormous impact of powerful different kinds of programs like Lean Six Sigma, which you would know, that has changed manufacturing processes forever.
Right.
There are systems like that that impact logistics.
Mm-hmm.
There's processes like that are really making big strides in healthcare. So the point of it is what is happening today is every organization is getting a lot better with a lot fewer people. Now what that means is that if we stay steady state, we're going to continue to be able to produce what we've already always produced, but our unemployment is going to go up and up and up.
Correct.
Okay? Mm-hmm. The only way that we can employ that productivity off what the spinoff of the productivity process is to grow.
Got it.
The economy's got to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just to keep unemployment at 8 or 9%. And it's got to grow fast to get employment down to what I would call a healthy unemployment rate. And that's a horrible – if you're one of the 6%, it isn't healthy at all.
Yeah, that's right.
But if you get your unemployment to 6%, then you've got a very strong economy that can take care of your growth, your people growth. So it's a – I see that in terms of corporations that are much bigger than they were 10 years ago making – extraordinarily good profits. I mean, U.S. corporations have made great profits the last 2 or 3 years with many fewer people.
Primarily because of the efficiency that they've been able to drive through some of those. So what do you see as the engine that will drive that kind of economic growth you mentioned that would certainly help with unemployment?
Well, simplistically, it's consumer spending.
Got it. Okay.
You know, and consumers will spend, one, if they've got a job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there now you've hit upon employment. Mm-hmm. Okay. They'll spend if they have confidence in what they're buying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they'll spend if they got confidence that tomorrow they won't need this money.
Mm.
And so you have to have both psychological and economic change in order, you know, for that consumer confidence to happen. I think consumer spending. I don't know what the percentage is, but it is so much bigger than the second largest, you know, spending avenue. It's all about me and you, and do we buy another used car or do we buy a new car?
That's right.
You know, and that's going to have a lot to do with our mood and our confidence.
Oh, how many kids you have that are actually in college? I'm talking about me. We get off of me. So thank you, Pat. I greatly appreciate that. So before we pivot back over to you, Sharon, I want to make sure everybody knows that today's edition of Global Leader Radio is sponsored in part by Quest 35 Housing. Their latest development, Quest Village 3, will be home to previously chronically homeless men, women, and veterans. And there's a link to Quest 35 on the Global Leader Radio website, and your quest for supportive housing starts here. So, Sharon, We talked a little bit about the movement that is Youth Spark Incorporated, and it is Youth Spark Incorporated, correct? Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about some of the things and some of the reasons why you're so passionate and in your background as well. Are corporations today involved in your movement as well?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think in the earlier years of this movement, corporations were more leery of getting involved. And, some of those reasons are obvious. I mean, it hasn't been a popular cause. I mean, I hate to apply that word, but I'd have to use that
That's
word.
Weird. Mm-hmm.
And now that more and more people, again, are waking up to this and understanding what it is and what the threat is, more and more corporations are becoming concerned and becoming more involved. So one of the key corporations that we are actually partners with is Microsoft.
Ah.
So Microsoft Corporation has launched within the past, they've always done work in terms of, giving to the community, but they expanded into a global initiative specifically to reach out and narrow the opportunity divide. Mm-hmm. And so that is to be able to give opportunity for young people ages 14 to 24 to be able to access the type of resources, technology and otherwise, that will allow them to actually, become citizens that are able to, have productive, successful journeys. And so they've started partnering with many other nonprofits nationally and throughout the globe. And we have the privilege of being one of the only domestic partners that specializes in working to transform the lives of kids who have been exploited, abused, and neglected. And interestingly enough, their global initiative is also called Youth Spark. It's called Microsoft Youth Spark. So,
really?
Yeah,
so they adopted?
Great minds think alike.
Oh, so they have the name independent of you, or are they adopted?
Yeah, literally the name is independent of each other.
Great minds do think alike.
Yeah, yeah.
So now we're going to switch gears a little bit from certainly what you actually do, both Pat and Sharon, and actually talk a little bit about the leadership it takes to do it. So we'll start with you, Sharon. So how do you define leadership?
Man, that's an outstanding question. I'm going to say two things about it. One, I really want to echo. I loved what you shared, Pat. I was sitting on the edge of my seat, inspired as well. And one of the things that you said about a leader trains other leaders, and a strong leadership model is leading leaders. I really agree with that, and I think for me it's one of the key ways that I would define leadership as well. But I defined a leader is someone that has true vision. It's kind of like it's a twofold proposition. It's being able to bring true vision to whatever it is you are leading and working to accomplish, and then it's the ability to actually put that vision into motion, if you will.
Mm.
And by that I mean the operations of it all, to be able to do both. Because if you are a visionary but you don't know how to translate your vision into action, then it stays a dream,
Right.
So I think it's that dual ability. And then, of course, obviously also to make the judgment to build a truly committed and powerful team. And again, I think that, building a team of leaders is very key, because I think even as you're leading, especially when you're leading in something like what I do, you also always want to be thinking about who's coming behind you as well to carry on this work. If you're the only person that can do it, then it's the old adage, if you get hit by a bus, it's like game over, right? So those are some of the key attributes, I think. I also believe that, of course, passion is essential. I'm going to incorporate that with vision in that sense.
Okay.
And then in addition, I think it's the ability to truly motivate as well, to motivate and to inspire a sense of confidence and commitment among the team that you're building and developing and being a part of. I think you've got to be a team player. And I love what you said also about humility, because I think that in order to be a leader, it's also about understanding when you're standing in front and also when you're supporting the team and standing in the back and just helping to make it happen. It's not, a leader is not just always about being the person that's standing in front of the line, not by any stretch
Great
of the
point.
Imagination.
Great point. Pat, your thoughts? How would you define leadership?
Well, I remember how Gandhi was surrounded by some reporters, and he said, "Well, I really apologize because I have to leave. Those are my people that are leaving, and I'm their leader." And so, so So he had to catch up with his people and get out front and be the leader. I think that one of the things that I try to do quickly in the class is indicate that you don't have to be a people person to be a good leader. You don't have to necessarily lead people to be a good leader. You might take leadership, a leadership role in something non-human. Now, that is important work. Mm-hmm. And in corporate world, it's very lucrative work, mm-hmm. okay? But I also say, but that's not what we're about in this class. What we're about is getting the most out of people.
Yeah.
And picking the right people, putting them in the right jobs, putting them in an area of success. Nick Saban, you know, said as a famous football coach, he always says that all I want to do is get somebody with some talent free to have the ball in their hands and then make a play. Mm-hmm. And so what you want to do is you want to make sure that your people can handle something when they get dealt it, give them an opportunity to get dealt it, and then let them take it from there. And if you have people that have a shared vision, they all know where the goal line is. And that's one thing great about football. You know what the vision is mm-hmm. for accomplishment. It's that goal line.
It's the beauty of sports.
You yeah. know? And so if you have if you don't have a shared vision, I mean, I know that Sharon runs into that all the time because she has the passion for young women that are being abused and being used by the lowest level human being on the planet or taking advantage of these children. And then she's got to find out, then what are we truly trying to do?
Yeah.
Are we trying to keep girls from being put in that situation, or are we trying to let them recognize it when they are so they'll fight back? Are we trying to, if you think of all the things they are, the actions or the operations of what they're trying to do, it has a shared vision. And so if you come out the other side of it, that some of these children that are being destroyed are going to be fewer.
Yeah.
And fewer.
And you'll then have an impact, right?
And so that if you can do that in an organization right down to the most brand new employee hired, if they know what your goals are and what the shared vision is, then you don't have to hover over them to see how they're doing it because they know where they're trying to go. And if you will allow mistakes, you will allow education to happen. And so it's also empowerment. Will I allow you to make that decision even if I know there's a higher chance of you making a mistake than me making that mistake because I've seen it before?
Well, thank you both for that discussion and of the elements of leadership that facilitate your ability to do what you both do. And so in the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, we use the Kuzes and Posner model, which is what you perhaps are familiar with, Pat, certainly. And it's the same word that you all used. And so facilitating change by inspiring a shared vision, challenging the existing process, enabling others to act or empowering them, and then encouraging the heart by celebrating the values and then recognizing the contributions that people actually bring to the plate. And so with that in mind, I did want to ask you a question, Sharon. So how many people together are involved in the movement?
You know, I can't really put a number to it.
Okay.
And the reason that I say that is because, first of all, it's, you know, I hope it's growing even as I'm talking. But second of all, because it's all walks of life, right? So mm-hmm. so basically I was talking about, you know, like young people who are more and more becoming leaders in this movement, right? And we've actually launched the Youth Spark Igniters. Those are young people in high schools who are saying, or in organizations, youth organizations, who are beginning to band together and who partner with us as Youth Spark and are beginning to create their own awareness raising process and process of being able to put actions into motion to support ending child sex trafficking. So that's one whole group. And then I really want to give a wonderful shout out here in Georgia to the collaborative effort that occurs to make change in this arena. There's the Governor's Office of Children and Families has been huge in launching a task force, a collective body of all different entities, be they nonprofits, law enforcement, U.S. Attorney's Office, and so on, other nonprofits, faith-based organizations, who all come together in one room for a collective impact model of making change in this arena.
Wow.
So again, that's another model. And then, of course, we have our children, actually girls and boys as well, who have been victimized, who have reclaimed their voice, and we have a affirmation, which is yesterday I found my voice, today I'm here to shout about it, who come together also as part of this movement for change. So because you've asked me that question, I'm going to go back and really start looking at what the numbers are, but mm-hmm. just with the example I've given you, it's just a huge and growing thing, and yet there's a lot more room and need for more people to join.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue to the next question I'm going to ask, because What we tell people at the Executive MBA program, and it doesn't matter to us if you come from the corporate side, if you're an entrepreneur or if you're working in not-for-profit, education makes a huge difference, at least in our opinion. Education makes a huge difference to your ability to move up in your corporation and to make a difference in the community. And so with that in mind, Pat, tell us how candidates can differentiate themselves in the marketplace based on what you know, especially knowing that the people who are listening to this program perhaps are, you know, the KSU alumni and a lot of other people who are listening in to try to get a few tips and a little bit of advice from a sage like yourself.
Well, you know, I probably have interviewed more managers and executives than probably anybody in Georgia.
Mm.
Thousands and thousands of interviews over a very long life.
We're not going there.
I would think that there is a requirement in today's presentation of somebody that's trying to seek a position of their knowledge of what they're applying to, of their research. I mean, at your fingertips right there is more research than any human's ever had in the world ever before.
Mm-hmm.
In split seconds at 186,000 miles per minute. And so anyway, the point of it is that if you go into an interview unprepared, there's no one to blame but yourself. Yeah. And if someone would hire somebody that's unprepared, shame on them. So that's the first thing I think about.
Well, I love that. And so keeping in that theme, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you ran a large public company and then a startup. So what's the difference between those two? I know you perhaps thought it would be a different story for a different day, but maybe you just want to touch on the very top levels, especially with regard to leadership and perhaps global leadership, of what it takes to do those two.
Well, I think there's a lot of financial differences, but that's not the topic of today. There's a huge amount of financial differences.
Okay.
A startup by definition.
Okay.
Is going to look at every single penny a lot more carefully, because you don't know if the next investor will invest. But the leadership part of it has to do with dual processing.
Okay.
And that you often can take some of your most snarly problems when you're leading a big company and find the right person that knows the most about that and is the most action-oriented.
In the company
to get this fixed for you.
Mm.
When you're leading a startup, you can't do that.
Mm.
You've got to figure a way to do it yourself.
Wow.
And you've got to, I always tell people in entrepreneurial situations, know what you do well and do more of it.
Hmm.
You know, and don't try, if you're really trying to fix something that you don't know the subject matter well enough, you have just said that's where you need to invest some of your precious resources.
Okay.
Don't try to spend your time getting up to speed in a subject matter that no matter if you spend 100 hours at it, you're not going to be as good as someone down the street already knows.
Right.
And those things you have to find out how soon you can get up to speed, because now if you start a company, technology is a big decision. And are you a techie?
Hmm.
If you're not a techie, then how do you get that technology done if it's necessary for success?
In a quick enough time to have an impact that you need, right?
All those things.
Yeah.
And so if you're not a techie, first thing, admit it.
I like that. That's hard for a lot of people to do.
Oh, it is.
I don't know it all.
And I mean, I will see. I saw my staff one time, five of them crowded around a laptop. And they said, no, I think you need to do. And then someone else said, well, let's try this. And I said, okay, now we just spent with half my staff has just spent a half hour on a problem that none of you know the answer to. So the point of it is that technology solution is always going to be big with an entrepreneur. Whereas with a big corporation, you're going to have an IT person that is going to be so much more attuned to the problems there than you ever could be.
A great thought.
So that's one of the many things that are different. And I will tell you very clearly, you can be an extraordinary leader in a corporate setting and really bad at a startup.
Yeah. So. Interestingly enough, I do have another question that perhaps will touch on both of the sectors that you work in. With regard to startups or not-for-profits and even corporations that don't have the resources they need, isn't it somewhat, I guess it does make a little sense, and in some cases makes a lot of sense, to then come up, figure out a way to either buy that resource or bring that resource on as an advisor and have them on your board? Right. And that can be personal as well as professional, because I hear mentors and coaches, and to me they're just like advisors. Right. So what are your thoughts on both of those? Do you have advisors and or a board perhaps at YouthSpark?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a board of directors at YouthSpark. And, you know, they're made up of a number of excellent, you know, skill sets and expertise. Everything. We've got several lawyers, actually.
Right.
But, you know, lawyers, financial experts, public relations experts, business, you know, technology experts, people, you know, we've got an amazing lawyer that does family law, so really understands the nature of the work that we do as well. So it's a really good mix.
So that keeps you from having to be so deep in those areas because you have someone there that, who can, right, to kind of offset that understanding.
Yeah, I'm pretty deep in it, too. Yeah.
But there are some places, and for example, technology, as Pat was mentioning, do you go very deep in that? How does technology play a role in what you do?
Leverage outstanding technology resources.
There we go. So, Pat, it is true that if you move from a corporation to a startup, does that happen often, though? Do people set up a board of directors?
Yeah. I mean, a startup will have probably a golden period where only the founder is involved, and he and his family or she and her family will be the board for a while.
Okay.
But just as soon as you take somebody else's money, there is fiduciary responsibilities for that money, and then you've got to quit playing around with it anymore, and you've got to have at least an advisory board, if not not a board of directors. So it's the management of investors' money that requires the board, that governance is required to come on board.
That drives that, and that's by regulation, or?
Well, it's certainly by regulation under certain different structures.
Okay.
And banks who lend money will insist on it.
Got it.
And so the point of it is that at some point in time in your maturity, you're going to have a board. So if you're going to have a board, then the first thing you need to do is say what skill sets do I need? And then you do that first before you start picking out people that can be. In our case, when we started the small company, ACT Bridge, that you mentioned earlier, we knew that there was going to be an exit from a financial standpoint, either an IPO or a purchase or whatever. There's going to be an exit somewhere in our three to five-year plan. Well, we needed somebody that lived in that world. You know, we needed someone that did mergers and acquisitions for a living. And so we could then prepare ourselves properly and then have been the right kind of ship and come to the right kind of dock when we needed to make that exit.
Okay. Well, very good. And so let me ask another question, too. If you actually could go back in time and give one piece of career advice to your younger self, what would that piece of advice be?
Try to learn when you have the wonderful opportunity to be in a college setting rather than make a grade.
So focus on learning versus grades.
Yeah. Learn something. I had to learn accounting all over again when I became an executive because I didn't pay attention when I and to me, a good solid C+ in accounting, you know, that was fine. You know,
it's a passing grade.
And so, thank goodness I didn't make too many C+s. But the point of it is, I mean, the maturity level of being in a learning environment and being mature enough to know while I'm here, I've got all these beautiful minds that are sitting in one building, and they'll take time with me if I just ask for it. And so to take advantage of that learning opportunity, it's just, I mean, it's so tough when you get out in the work world and you didn't pay attention. You know?
Good point. Sharon, what do you think?
I was sort of wondering if you were going to ask me. I was like, okay, maybe he's not going to ask me that.
Maybe that's just Pat's question.
But I was thinking about it while you. So I'm a person, I don't really believe in regrets. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I do believe in learning, of course, and I again, I love what you said earlier about the recognition that making mistakes is fine and it's actually healthy. So, you know, kind of that I read about the concept of failing forward. So I really like that. So what I'm going to say, though, is I think in given all that, I would go back and I would tell my former self just to absolutely have faith in the process and the journey and just like whatever it is, just, you know, like going for it and believing in whatever it is you're shooting for, you know, and not worrying about it, just going for the gusto with that.
You're saying go boldly forward.
Right. Yes, I am. Go boldly forward. But it's that recognition of not, you know, of knowing that it's going to be okay, because sometimes I think when we hesitate, you know, the reason really is because we're wondering, okay, well, what are the ramifications, or, you know, can I really do this, or so on. But, you know, life is meant to be lived. And I am a person that goes for it, but sometimes I would go for it thinking, okay, wow, it's, but really have faith and just, you know, whether you're failing forward or succeeding forward, it's all the same thing. It's part of the process and the journey.
Well, it sounds like you may have had a model or an idol or a role, or somebody you looked at over the years. So who have you admired that has impacted your leadership style?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I'm going to take a little – I was reading this book.
Right.
And it's actually called Jesus as CEO.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, we've heard of that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Good deal. Okay. So in reading the book, I mean, of course, I've thought of Jesus as a leader before, mm-hmm. but the book highlighted his leadership style for me in a whole other fashion. And, you know, there's one thing it talks about when it talks about if you're bold, you know, mm-hmm. be 10 times bolder. And I really admire that, you know, because when you're especially, again, I think this is true whether you're in the corporate world or in the nonprofit world, and I've worked in a variety, and I've worked in all these arenas.
Right.
If you're going for something, you really do have to be bold, whether it's in your belief, whether it's in the legal brief that you've written, or, you know, the negotiation or the argument that you're presenting, or whether it's about the issue that you're fighting for. So.
Okay, and Pat?
So Jesus is the short answer there.
And that's very good. And we appreciate you taking that and taking us around. That's great.
Yeah.
Pat, what are you thinking? Who have you admired that has impacted your leadership style?
I do. When I get in environments, I kind of see someone and I'm impressed by what they're accomplishing, and I spend some time observing them. It's never one person.
Okay.
I mean, it rolls through. There was a head coach that I worked for when I was an assistant coach in high school,
mm-hmm.
and he just had a way. You know, he just had a way to make everybody listen.
Okay.
I mean, he just had. There was just something about him, and his way of making everyone listen is to speak softer. And He would get everybody leaning in towards him, and then he would shout, and man, that point that he was trying to make, he just made it.
It brought you in, right?
So there's tactics, there's things that you can live with that help you along the way. But the one thing that I've always seen in common with all these people, these different people along the way, is they always work so hard. They're dedicated to their subject matter or their job or their career. They're dedicated to something where they just worked hard. And they didn't try to outthink every toiling job there was. They just said, the only way I'm going to get out of this mess is work my way out of it. And so it's something that I try to give lots of examples to my students.
Well, great.
Can I add one thing to that?
Certainly.
You know, I was thinking in the past of like the leaders in my past, but I actually want to acknowledge the leaders that I'm coming in contact with in the future. And so my two boys are 9 and 10, Joshua Ryan Joseph and Robert Luke Joseph. But what I am observing in them is their leadership emerging. Mm-hmm. And even sometimes now I'm learning from them as a leader. And so I think that's really important. It doesn't have to be someone in your past. It can be someone that you're around, whether they're a kid or an adult, you know, that you can learn from.
And this is this conversation is really fun for me because you've now provided the third great segue for me, which is when you think through your leadership legacy, what are you most proud of as a leader?
Well, most leaders, I think, would be the success of their subordinates.
Okay.
You know, when you look back and somebody that worked for you a long time ago is really doing well in life and they're well in their career. And
that's the case for you.
I mean, occasionally I'll have someone come up and say, you know, I took your lessons in leadership class at UGA 12 years ago, and I've got to tell you, I've used this idea. It really has helped me. That's kind of the food for a teacher, to hear that from a past student.
Absolutely.
So
I would agree. Sharon?
I was going to stipulate to my previous answer, but I will add to that. I would say I am, and I'm in the midst of it too. I mean, I feel that I am taking this journey, the leadership journey, with love and courage. That those are qualities that I'm bringing, and that I am not fearful of showing those and giving those to the people that I serve with, if you will. And the people that I lead. And I think it's a really powerful legacy because I do believe that regardless of the environment that you're in, it's qualities of that nature of love and courage that really do make the difference in succeeding in what you're seeking to accomplish.
And I would agree. What are you both doing to ensure you continue to grow and develop as a leader?
Just stay in the fight for me.
Stay in the fight. And the fight means in the classroom? Is that
well,
it?
Well, no. That means out in the business world.
In the business world as well?
That means in the not-for-profit ventures that I'm involved in. Just stay in the fight.
Perfect.
I'm a bookworm. I'm a huge reader. So I read lots of, you know, kind of cutting-edge leadership books and books about organizational infrastructure and so on. But in addition, we are part of the Georgia Center for Nonprofits, and
okay.
They have a CEO Perspectives program that I just completed, and it was outstanding. It's just really conferring with other CEOs in the type of arenas that I'm in, and I think that's huge. So I'm always committed to growth and exploration.
And what's it called again?
It's called the CEO Peer Perspectives
Program. Yeah. P-E-E-R.
Right, exactly. Yes.
Interesting. And, you know, again, you've provided yet another segue for me. So my next to last question for both of you will be, which book has most impacted your leadership ability?
Well, I've always thought business books have one good point. And once you've read that point, you don't need to read even more. And it's usually in the first five chapters. And once you've got that, now the fellow that's writing the book knows that he's got to produce, you know, 225 pages. And now he's just, you know, blown his wad, you know, and on the first 50 pages. The books that I think that have impacted me are seldom business books.
Okay.
I think they're biographies.
Okay.
And I love the biographies of our presidents.
Okay.
I think probably the greatest leader that ever was, maybe in the world of governance, is George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But the scale of what he had to deal with was quite small.
Mm-hmm.
And he could go next door and talk to the person that was messing something up and kind of get it back on track again.
Get the influence.
You know? So I guess if you take that into consideration, you have to go with Abraham Lincoln. And I've read about 4 or 5 biographies on Lincoln, and I never tire of him or his life or how he accomplished things. I think the most impressive thing about him is of the first 11 elections that he attempted, he lost.
Every last one of them.
He never quit. And he kept shooting for something either higher each and every time. Well, he finally became a junior senator from Illinois and then a couple of years later president of the United States. And so the point of it is as Jimmy Valvano would say, you know, never, 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 never quit. So I think for me the greatest leadership books have been the biographies of our presidents.
Has there been a specific one that sticks out for you or no?
You know, there was one, and I'm sorry I can't remember the name of the lady that wrote this biography, and she was the most awesome researcher in the world, and she never said a single thing if she didn't have some document to back up her opinion. It was tedious to read. I mean, and it was that thick. It was 10 Bibles thick. But when you were finished with it, you really felt you knew Abraham Lincoln. Then there's the normal historical writers that have all written on Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, great, thank you, Sharon. Which book has most impacted your leadership ability?
I mentioned already Jesus as CEO, mm-hmm. And I share Pat's belief on the fact that it's not always a book per se, though, about like here's what a leader is, X, Y, and Z. I read this wonderful series of books by Octavia Butler, and she's actually a science fiction author, cutting edge slice of life merged in with that. She wrote 2 books called Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, and in them it's a futuristic novel about a woman who's a leader, and what she kind of launches her own new sense of what really makes the world the world. And she says that change, and so basically she sort of worships the concept of change, because she says that change is the only true constant that exists. You have to read the book to really get the whole, catch the vision. But the point is that I love the fact that she does not shy away from change, mm-hmm. and that she chooses to have the courage to really look at it and to embrace it, you know? Because I do think that, life is constantly changing and evolving, and if you can have the courage and the insight to recognize that, then it will allow you to have a journey that's a lot more powerful and arguably in its own way joyful and more successful. So that's what I would say. And I guess I would add to that, so I have this concept that I look at life as if you're carrying kind of like a little carry-on bag for life. You guys can call it a toolkit too, right? And when you stop at each juncture of a journey, you think, well, okay, you go through a series of experiences. What is it that I'm going to take out of that experience? Like leave the junk and the baggage behind, but what's the powerful lesson that I learned? So like for me, like I said, running this organization, it's about recognizing I have love and courage in that toolkit, and it's leaving out the part about where I pull out my hair and all that.
Right.
Stuff, which we all know as leaders is part of the journey. And so here's the part where I do want to acknowledge it's my own book that captures that, but I've written a book called In How My Spirit Soars, and it's like kind of like the Diary of Anne Frank, where mm-hmm. she has this journal that tells the story of her journey, and she's my other favorite. But anyway, in the book, I just say every experience you go through, you can take the positive, powerful thing, put that in your bag, and keep stepping and have that with you always.
Very good. Very good. So Sharon and Pat, on behalf of our learning community, I truly appreciate you accepting the invitation to join us today. And I'd love to have you back on the show sometime in the future if we can get our schedules all synced up. Would that be a deal?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And with that in mind, my final question is, can you tell us how our learning community can contact you either by email and or by phone?
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, they can contact me at pittard, that's PPITTARD, at uga.edu.
And so our website is youth-spark. I'm going to spell that Y-O-U-T-H dash, that's the hyphen, spark, S-P-A-R-K dot org. If you go online, you can find us there, and we are doing a Route to Change duathlon that you can learn about. And if you want to email me, you can email me at sjoseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, at youth-spark.org. Thank you.
Fantastic. So additionally, as a special thank you for appearing on today's show, I have a copy of the book Business Acumen 2, which is Insights from the Faculty and Friends of the Coles College of Business for each of you.
Thank you.
And with that smile, I certainly like that. We've also got a bookmark in it for you for the Executive MBA to allow you and the folks that you know to be able to connect with us on social media. So with that response, we'll bring today's edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. And we invite all our listeners to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. Also, please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu if you have recommendations for guests. Additionally, feel free to reach out. Even if you have not dropped me an email, you can pick up the phone and give me a call. Certainly, that's how we have both our guests in here today. Connie actually connected me with you, and Michael J. Coase connected Pat here with us today as well. So for those of you interested in our award-winning Executive MBA program, please go to the EMBA icon on our Global Leader Radio site to connect to us and sign up for an information session. So join us again at this same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with passionate people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.